We'll start the committee meeting of the Energy, Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee. We don't have a quorum. We probably don't need a quorum, but I would like my members to be here to hear this. I think that it's a very important part of the education of the committee. So I'm anticipating they'll be wandering in very soon. The telecommunications industry has undergone some significant changes in recent years because of developments in technology and also because of new entrants into the market. We will be putting aggressive broadband access and speed goals into law later this session. And we hope that Minnesota will be at the forefront nationally of speed goals and penetration. The FCC has recently released a report making recommendations for broadband build-out across the country. And given the pace of change in this field and the expectation of meeting our goals by 2015, this meeting is an important opportunity to hear from the various providers in the state regarding challenges, opportunities, and obstacles to providing competitive service throughout Minnesota with some historical context. So we're going to do this in two parts. I'm going to ask representatives from the telecommunications industry to come to the table. And the first would be Randy Young, Mike Martin, and Bob Bass. Oh, okay. If you gentlemen prefer to come, there's actually plenty of room up here if you'd come up together, if you don't mind doing that. Unless that's too close.
Very friendly.
Well, wait. Oh, are you presenting at this time too? Okay. And Patrick Fusick.
Jim Bird.
I'm sorry.
Subbing.
We got the wrong name here. His name? Okay. And we're asking them to give us some historical context for their industries and address some of the regulatory, how they're regulated and what are some of the access issues. So who's going to start? I have Randy Young first. Does that seem okay? Randy, and introduce
Chair,
yourself for the record.
Committee, thank you for this opportunity on behalf of the whole panel to give you a little bit of perspective and background in the communications industry. And I use that word communications industry because I don't think that we have a telephone or a cable or a wireless industry. We really do have a communications industry today. I'm going to try during this portion of the hearing not to be an advocate but more to be an historian. I got real excited when Will indicated that you were looking for some history and background on the industry because I taught telecommunications regulatory policy for 10 years at St. Mary's. So I dusted off my old notes, and hopefully you won't get too bored with that. Minnesota is somewhat unique among all the states in the number of telephone companies that we have. No one has ever been able to tell me why a quarter of all the telephone companies, incumbent telephone companies in the nation, are in Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Only Iowa and Wisconsin have more companies than we do. And I think because of that, it's allowed for a lot of creativity and a lot of development in the industry over the years. Nonetheless, whether it's a large company like Qwest or one of the smaller companies, they're all experiencing decreases in access lines. We really hit the peak in the number of access lines that our companies have in about the year 2000. And since then, we've seen the number decrease on an annual basis. On a national basis, I don't have Minnesota statistics, unfortunately, but on a national basis, in 2003, the telephone industry lost about 5% of its access lines. That's continued. It's actually been accelerating. And last year, the last 2 years, that's been up around 11% loss. Obviously, you're adding 11% to 11% to 11%, or even at the 5% level, and those numbers add up rather quickly. The structure of the industry here in Minnesota is such that Qwest is by far the largest telephone company in the state. It's what we classify as a large company. We have three mid-sized companies in Minnesota, Frontier Citizens, TDS, and CenturyLink. Those four companies, including Quest, represent about 85% of the access lines here in the state. The other 15% are served by the 75 independent telephone companies around the state. These tend to be rural telephone companies. About a third of them are co-ops. About two-thirds of them are family-owned. And then we have two municipal telephone companies in the state, incumbent telephone companies. These were companies that were created 50, 60 years ago when no one would come into their community to provide service, Cross Lake and Burnsville. So the municipality stepped up to the plate at that point and created a telephone company that's been the incumbent there ever since. The independents range in size from probably the largest is around 30,000 access lines to the smallest of 50 access lines. Northern Telephone Company in Wawena, Minnesota. Teacher and his wife still run the telephone company and are providing the advanced services to many of their customers as well. The bulk of the companies tend to be in the 3,000 to 4,000 access line range to kind of give you a sense of the scope of them. The independent telephone companies provide service to half of the geography of the state, 15% of the customers, but half the geography. Obviously, they're providing service to very sparsely populated areas, small communities, and as a result, they face some unique situations that we'll talk about a little further in the testimony. The legislature has recognized for many years that these smaller telephone companies, the statute sets a number at 50,000 access lines, are different than the larger companies. And the legislature and the PUC have regulated those smaller companies with a lighter hand than they have the larger companies, understanding their smallness, their unique situation, and their closeness to their communities. So as a result, they are, for the most part, under a different regulatory regime than the larger companies in the state. Minnesota's got a very healthy competitive marketplace. Our local telephone companies are facing competition from a number of different sources using a number of different technologies. The cable industry, for example, is competing with us today as we are with them. They are unregulated in their offering of voice service. They have no regulatory or rate obligations as we do. 20% of the households in Minnesota today do not have a landline telephone. Not too many years ago, we assumed that it was just the younger kids that were just getting out of college and setting up their homes and their households that probably wouldn't have that phone on the desk or phone on the wall. But today we're seeing that spread beyond just kids graduating from college and setting up their first household. But again, 20% of Minnesota households today are using cell phone or no phone as their means of communications and not a landline phone. Again, the wireless companies are not regulated at the state level as we are. And of course, we have VoIP as well, voice over internet protocol that travels over the broadband network. They are not regulated either. Much of these differences in regulation are due to some historical consequences and the different histories of the different organizations. The telephone industry was obviously of the three industries that are at the table now. The oldest started at the beginning and began with a regulatory regime that is far different from the other industries. A lot of the vestiges from that regulatory regime we're still living with today, even though the world has changed and the landscape has changed. It was in the early 20th century that Minnesota began to regulate the telephone company in the 1815-1817 range. And it saw the telephone industry as a natural monopoly. That is, it made more sense to treat that industry as a monopoly with one provider in a geographic area than to have a number of providers competing. The early industry here in Minnesota was rather chaotic with literally thousands of telephone companies. Many very small towns had numerous telephone companies. They refused to interconnect with each other. Merchants in town had to have service and phones from two or three different phone companies in order to get calls from their customers, and many residential customers had to have a number of telephones and a number of phone services in order to communicate. As a result of that, and again, the notion of a natural monopoly, the state in 1917 created what was then the Railroad and Warehouse Commission, which later became the Public Service and the Public Utilities Commission, And one of their charges was to regulate the telephone industry in the state. And they did that under a regulatory compact, or a quid pro quo. The state got some things out of the arrangement, and the telephone industry got some things out of the arrangement. What did the state get? Well, the state got ubiquitous service for everyone in Minnesota who wanted telephone service. They were able to control and set rates and the terms and conditions for telephone service. They mandated that all the telephone companies in the state interconnect with each other. And they also regulated the quality of service that customers were having. And it eliminated that little literal forest of lines and telephone poles that were in so many of the small rural communities. In exchange for that, the telephone industry, each telephone company had an assigned service area. They became the sole telephone service provider in that assigned area. They had the ability to earn up to the allowed rate of return that the regulators would set for that company, and they were able to recover the cost of providing that telephone service. This was a very nice arrangement, both for the state, for customers, and for the industry as well. And that could happen because of the technology that was being used back in those days. There was no competition. The state could disallow that competition. So as a result, the state could also manipulate the rates because there was no competitive pressure on any of the telephone companies. They could artificially set, and they did artificially set, business rates high and long-distance rates high in order to keep residential rates artificially low. That worked well, again, for everyone, and it allowed for the fulfillment of the federal universal service policy that was enacted in 1934. Up until recently, well over 97-98% of Minnesotans had a phone because of the universal service policy and this regulatory regime that had been put in place and this regulatory compact. Unfortunately, that regulatory compact no longer exists, and it's no longer sustainable. The reason for that is because of technology. New technologies have been developed both at the long-distance level as well as at the local exchange level, and that has basically disallowed that arrangement that the state and the telephone industry was able to have in the past. Because of, in the old days, just a central office switch, an old stepper switch, and copper wires, there was no other technology that could compete with the telephone company, so the state could, in effect, have an assigned service area for an individual company and keep that monopoly, keep the benefits that customers and the state had with that monopoly in place. When new technologies began to come into place, and that began as early as 1963 with MCI beginning to compete with AT&T, this whole compact that we'd had began to fall apart. It was no longer sustainable because technology didn't allow for that monopoly to continue. We saw that the incumbent companies, however, had to continue to live under the compact. That is, they had these artificially set rates where business rates were artificially high above the cost of providing service and residential rates were low. That allowed competitors to come in both in the long-distance market as well as in the local market and to compete for those artificially high rates that the incumbent telephone company was charging because they didn't have to support artificially low residential rates. And they could come in and compete and pick off the business customers. That began the deterioration of the quid pro quo that the state and the telephone industry had. We saw further changes in the industry, of course, in 1984 with the breakup of AT&T at the national level. It created seven baby bells, as they were known, one long-distance company and seven regional companies, US West, Ninex, Ameritech, Bell Atlantic, Pac Bell, Southwestern Bell. None of those companies are around any longer because of further evolution in the industry. Another landmark, of course, was the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996 that changed substantially the original Telecommunications Act of 1934. And that set the framework that exists today for encouraging and fostering a competitive marketplace. In Minnesota today, we've got over 200 CLECs, competitive local exchange carriers, competing with the incumbent telephone companies. And we have almost 150 companies that are offering long-distance service in a competitive market here in Minnesota. Even small communities around the state have got 50 or 60 choices of long-distance carriers that they can choose from. The fundamental restructuring of the industry and the regulatory regime in 1984 resulted in the creation of the Universal Service Fund. Prior to that, with the rate manipulation that could go on with artificially high or low rates, you really didn't need a Universal Service Fund. A lot of that could have happened within AT&T, old Ma Bell in itself, and there were relationships developed between AT&T and the independent telephone companies to provide support for high-cost customers. That all went away with the divestiture of AT&T in 1984, and as a result, the FCC and Congress created the Universal Service Fund, and that's surcharge that's put on the customers pay on their phone bills in order to help support the high-cost customers around Minnesota and around the country. Now, even within the industry, we have a little different perspective, I think, on the USF. I'll just give you the small telephone company perspective, and Quest and the others can talk about their perspectives.
Let me just ask, what's a high-cost customer? Somebody in a sparse area? Or?
That's right. Customers that are remotely located. We have customers in Minnesota where the actual cost of providing basic service is anywhere from $80 to $90 a month. Obviously, that's not a sustainable cost for a customer. As a result, independent telephone companies really have three sources of income today to pay for the cost of providing that service to their customers. The first element is the rates that they charge their customers. Historically, that's been about a third of their revenues. The second third of the revenues has come from access charges, and that's what the long-distance companies pay the local telephone company for using their network to begin and to complete calls to their long-distance customers. If they didn't use our networks, they would have to literally go out and build their own networks just for long-distance to serve their long-distance customers. So they use our network and then pay us on a per-minute use to begin and to complete their long-distance calls. That was another third of our revenue stream. And the third element, which was about a third, was the Universal Service Fund, again, set up by Congress, administered by the FCC, to help defray the cost so that rural rates would continue to be affordable, as well as being able to provide new technologies to rural communities. With that obligation, or the revenues that come from the Universal Service Fund, there are obligations. We have to be the carrier of last resort in our communities and our service areas. When a new development is built, or if a customer wants service, we have to provide them service no matter what the cost is. Historically, that wasn't too much of a problem. We knew that anyone that was building a home or moving into the area was going to have telephone service, so we knew we had a revenue stream coming in. Today, we're finding, particularly in suburban areas, but in rural areas as well, where developments are going in, we're obligated to put lines in to every home there, and we may have a third or half of the customers that are taking service. The others are using cable for their telephone service or using wireless, but we're still obligated to put that line in and maintain that line, even though no one's using it. Universal service is available to anyone who wants to provide service in those communities. They can get a certificate from the Public Utilities Commission. They become an ETC, an eligible telecommunications carrier. They have to accept the same obligations, but then they have available to them the same funds that the local incumbent telephone companies have as well. The legislature over the years has understood that the environment is changing and has made a number of attempts to give some alternative forms of regulation starting as early as the late 1980s. The most recent one, and I think the one that's probably been the most successful, is what's called the A4 plan, the alternative form of regulation. And that is really a compact, again, on a company-by-company basis between the regulators and the telephone company, acknowledging that there is competition and setting the level of regulation based on the amount of competition that that telephone company is experiencing. Larger companies like Quest, Frontier Citizens, TDS, and CenturyLink go in about every 4 years, renegotiate this compact, this A4, with the regulators, get it approved by the Public Utilities Commission, and then they can operate under that A4 for the next 4 years. Small companies under 50,000 have got a statutorily created A4 plan where they just acknowledge or file with the commission indicating we want to fall under the A4 plan, and then the statute says here are the terms and conditions, so that each small company doesn't have to sit down every few years and renegotiate with the regulators. Historically, excuse me, I'm losing my voice, Madam Chair. Historically, we've seen that the technologies and the services that regulate the different industries have been different, because they were created at different times. They were providing different services. Originally, we provided telephone service. The telephone industry provided, the cable industry provided cable service, video service. The wireless industry had wireless. As a result, each has their own different type of regulation, their own statutes. Those were nice artificial boxes that worked well as long as we were all providing different services. Today, though, we're all providing the same services. We're all providing voice, we're all providing data, and we're all providing internet, and yet we're still under different regulatory regimes. And that's complicated, quite frankly, the industry and how the industry can move forward. Today, these artificial boxes, quite frankly, aren't working well. We're one industry, all providing the same services. We're just using different technologies and different platforms in order to provide those services. We're also seeing a healthy market here in Minnesota for CLECs, again, competitive local exchange companies. As I'd indicated earlier, we have over 200 CLEC applications and certificates, so that either independent providers can come in and compete with an incumbent telephone company, or often a neighboring telephone, an independent telephone company, will get a certificate to be a competitor in their neighboring telephone company's area and go in and compete there with the existing incumbent. So what's ahead for the industry here in Minnesota?
Mr. Young, give us a little background on the CLECs and what those are.
Sure, be glad to. Thank you very much. Through the 96 Act, as well as legislation here in Minnesota, incumbent telephone companies no longer have a monopoly. Anyone can come in and compete with a local telephone company. They get a certificate from the Public Utilities Commission, and then they are regulated with a lighter hand than the incumbent is. And the intent of that originally was to encourage and to foster competition. As a result, they can go in and in a matter of a very short period of time can get their certificate, maybe a 1 or 2 page form, not a whole lot of scrutiny, and then they can come in and compete with the incumbent telephone company. The cable industry has been doing that, and others have been doing that as well. They don't have the same obligations. They don't have to serve the same footprint as we do. They can come in and just serve Main Street if they want, again, picking off the lucrative business customers, or maybe they'll just provide service in town, but they won't go out into the countryside and provide service to the farmsteads, where we're obligated to provide that service. But they are a strong force in Minnesota. They are providing competition in Minnesota, and we think that it's a healthy form of competition. We just think that we need to be looking more closely, again, at these artificial boxes that were set up for regulation years ago that aren't working very well today. Well, where are we headed in the phone industry here in Minnesota? We've seen dramatic changes over the last 15 years, but we're seeing that that era is ending. We're seeing that the monopoly era is over with. There is no longer any such thing as monopoly. Technology has basically eliminated that regulatory compact that I talked about earlier. And today, technology is allowing for competition in all areas, not only in voice, but in cable, video, and in data as well. Technology is driving all of this change, and we don't see that it's changing in the future. I think one of the things that you have to deal with as policymakers is how can you keep up with the changing technology in your attempts to guide this industry into the future? Anyone who comes to us and says, well, we know where this industry is going to be in 10 years, we know what the technologies are going to be in 10 years, quite frankly, doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't think that you could talk to any of the experts at a national level who can give you a good prediction as to what technology is going to be like 10 years from now. You just look at the last 10 years, and you can see where changes will be coming. I did some, as an example of that, I did some consulting work a few years ago back in the 90s for the governor in Wisconsin. They had a broadband task force that had been set up to look at how can the state, Blue Ribbon task force set up to look at how can the state be using telecommunications as an effective economic development tool. I went back and looked at every state report, 26 of them, that states had done in the previous 5 years on economic development and telecommunications. 15 years ago, the word internet was not in a single one of those reports. And yet today, we can't live without it. So to predict 5 or 10 years from now where this industry is going to be, I think, is very difficult at best. That makes your job even more difficult in trying to decide how are we going to manage this transition and manage this marketplace if you and we don't know where the marketplace is going. As I said before, we're no longer telephone companies. We are communication companies. We are moving more and more toward focusing our business on broadband and not just on voice. With the decline in access lines that I'd indicated before, the handwriting is on the wall. We can't just be a phone company. Most of our companies today are either doing or looking at the triple play, offering voice, video, and data together. You can't make it any longer. You can't afford to put in the infrastructure that's needed to provide your customers with the service they need with just voice service. So we are now a communications industry that includes the other elements of that industry as well. We're looking at putting fiber deeper and deeper into our networks. Many of our companies are now doing fiber to the home, fiber to the farm. I have a cabin up in northern Minnesota. I have fiber going to my cabin today. I've got as much technology working up there as I do down here in the Twin Cities. Copper is still important. Copper is still valuable in that last mile that goes to the customer's house. You can provide voice, video, and data over copper that's been in the ground for many years. It'll still be a part of the industry, but we are moving more and more toward a fiber-based industry. Finally, I'd just like to again indicate that I think public policy needs to reflect the fact that we have a communications industry today. We don't have a telephone industry. We don't have a cable industry. We don't have a wireless industry. We have a communications industry. We're all providing the same services, and I think that in the future, if we're going to be able to move forward and provide the services, all three of the segments of this industry, we need to be viewed and we need to be regulated as a single industry and not as three separate industries that are stuck in historic boxes that don't make sense in today's environment. With that, Madam Chair, thank you so much for the time, and I'd be glad to answer any questions later on.
Okay. Anybody have any pressing questions at this point? Okay. Mr. Johnson, or Mr. Young, would you be willing to share your written notes with us later on? Send us a copy of those?
If I'm allowed to clean them up, I will.
Yeah, certainly. Okay. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mike Martin, Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. I want to thank you for this opportunity to present our response to the questions that were prepared. Believe me when I say the cable industry welcomes this opportunity, and I hope that by responding to these issues, it'll help understand where the cable industry has come from, where it is today, and where we are going in this very competitive age. I'd like to state at the outset that each of the questions could easily take several long workshop sessions to really completely cover, but in the interest
of... We have about an hour and 5 minutes left.
I'm moving
along. And we have a panel after this.
Yes, in the interest of time, I do have a written copy of specific answers to the questions, and hopefully in less than 15 minutes, Madam Chair, I can highlight the points that we think should be underscored. As you know, the cable industry has been the subject of a number of important legislative and regulatory initiatives at the federal level. Over the last six decades, our cable technology and our video products have evolved. The cable industry is really in its fourth or fifth generation of technology and regulation. And despite all the changes in federal policy and technology, cable has remained primarily a privately funded local service that is positioned to expand its service offering with the changing marketplace, to operate systems in competition with free broadcast television, direct satellite service, telephone, and other new entrants, and to serve local public, educational, and governmental communication needs. The cable industry has been the subject of dual levels of regulation. While the FCC imposed suffocating restrictions on the cable industry back in the 60s, and state and local governments developed an uncoordinated patchwork of regulations. State and local regulation resulted from industry's need to utilize public rights of way to construct plant in order to provide service. And these regulatory barriers and the limits in technology in those days really prevented cable from growing much beyond 20 or 25 systems that operated in Minnesota in the early 70s. Through action by the FCC, a congressional act in 1984, and again in 1992, the situation has really changed. New markets have been opened, rate regulation was significantly modified, and it became economically viable to build large metropolitan area cable systems offering advanced interactive service, this is amazing new diverse video options, and to offer peg channels and facilities serving local communities. Cable's amazing success in the 80s did result in a significant pushback from traditional competitors. The broadcasters in particular wanted protections against cable competition. Despite these measures, cable companies continued to invest and push for deregulation. This led to the enormous innovation and diversity in cable programming offerings that we have today. These federal laws have limited local franchise demands, deregulated certain rates, encouraged the emergence of alternative satellite programming, and carefully protected local free broadcast television. Subsequent to those changes, the Telecom Act of 1996 was passed and encouraged sweeping change in the telecommunications market. That landmark legislation opened important doors and enabled the cable industry to move ahead with full-scale investment in facilities-based competition to incumbent local exchange carriers. The Act established direct satellite companies, DirecTV and Dish Network, with guaranteed access to cable programming, and it created alternative franchising schemes for telephone companies to facilitate their entry into the video market. And most importantly, it enabled all telecom providers the opportunity to provide internet services. The 1996 Act really laid the groundwork for the bundled service competition that we have today. Where once cable companies were a limited channel video service, they would become today providers of bundled video, internet, and voice services. Thanks to an investment of billions of dollars, the industry has moved from community antenna service to state-of-the-art technology, offering video channels, internet service to millions of homes, and voice services in competition with local exchange carriers. And while we're looking at the regulatory side, it's important to note that cable developed a system architecture of hybrid fiber optic cable and coax cable that has dramatically extended and expanded the efficiency of cable systems. Market entry to cable is a capital-intensive process. Since 1996, the cable industry has invested over $160 billion. In the last 5 years nationally, the industry has invested billions each year in upgrades and improvements. In other words, setting aside regulatory channels, entering the cable business is not for the faint of heart. This massive investment is the reason why the cable industry is deeply troubled by proposals to lower barriers to municipal ownership. Competitive entry by municipalities is a highly speculative venture. The cable and telecommunications business is not like running a liquor store or a golf course. It's a dynamic, capital-intensive, complex business, much better suited to the private sector. Government should be in the business of governing, not competing. To enter the cable business, a cable company needs a franchise from each local government entity with jurisdiction over the areas the cable operator wants to serve. The franchises are non-exclusive, and there is no limit on the number of franchises a municipality can grant. Obtaining these franchises is typically accomplished through informal negotiation. It is a process that is designed to protect the public interest. Under federal law, cities have the right to establish, as part of that process, a granting of the franchise some of the following items. They can, for example, impose a franchise fee for the use of the public rights of way of up to 5% of the cable operator's gross revenue from cable services. Last year, that amounted to $3 billion nationally that was paid to local governments. The use of channel capacity for the delivery of PEG access programming to customers is required. Capital grants for PEG access production facilities are required. Free cable service to schools and other public buildings within the franchise areas are required. The construction of institutional networks that interconnect public buildings with telecommunications facilities is required. And service to the entire community with build-out requirements based on density ratios is also required. These amount to millions of dollars in services and savings to local communities. And while there are virtually no cross-ownership restrictions on entrants, only minimal level playing field provisions are required in the changing market. So again, it's not for the faint-hearted.
Mr. Martin?
Yes.
Were you, I'm not sure you meant to imply or if you were even making that comparison, that your infrastructure was more costly than, for instance, the telephone companies?
No, I don't know that it's more costly. I think it's just been a massive, we like to underscore the fact that it's been a massive investment.
However, there are municipal water utilities, power utilities, gas utilities, and they have a lot of infrastructure also. You were saying that it was very costly infrastructure and that municipalities couldn't get involved in the delivery of...
The point about municipal ownership is not that a cable plant would cost more. It's very, very different from operating a utility. If cities are used to building facilities and operating those facilities over a long period of time, but they essentially are static facilities. I mean, you maintain a sewer plant. It doesn't change. The technology in both telephone, cable has changed dramatically over the last 10 years. For cities,
but your infrastructure hasn't changed.
Oh, but it has. The plant elements of the plant. It is not a simple matter of running a fiber from a head end into a node somewhere and running into a home. It's a very, very different business. And cities that have gotten into the business have found out it requires a continual amount of investment. A lot of cities that were in the traditional video market, not the new bundled service, found it very, very difficult to keep up with the continuing investment. And many of those systems, in fact, in Minnesota have been turned over to sold to private industry to make the investment and to continue with that change in system management and technology changes that are required.
That probably is accurate. I can't understand why, I guess, most municipalities would even want to get involved in the business, except they can't get service.
Well,
and so they need to get service, and sometimes they find that's the only way they can do it.
Madam Chair, traditionally that was the entry point. Minnesota has had as many as 13 municipally owned cable systems that were created at a time when a very dismal time economically for the cable industry, and they could not get it. It was not economically viable. As I'll say later, it has to be economically viable because we have no There is no subsidy mechanism. There is no universal service fund that addresses high-cost areas and those types of issues. The service territory, which actually is the next point here, has to be an economically viable unit.
Senator Dibble has a question.
Thanks. Just a request of the chair. You know, I know that there are those with a fairly significantly different view from what's being presented. At some point, maybe we could hear from, like, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance or from some municipalities that have some success stories to report along these lines.
I am already aware that this is a broader subject than we've put together, you know, three key speakers and then a panel of five people, I think. And so we intend to hear a number of different viewpoints, but by the same token, we have left out the municipalities and other people who also can be key players in this. So we will continue to have discussions. This is meant as Telecom 101 to get us started. Okay.
Well, I would be interested in that. We have some real advocacy going on right now at the table, though, so I'm just interested in facts right now.
Okay. Continue, Mr. Martin.
Service territory is the next item here. The first step in the franchise process is to define the service territory, which in turn becomes a part of the franchise ordinance. The franchise authority defines that territory. In some cases, these territories are extended when adjacent communities seek line extensions or through joint powers agreements. However, in all cases, the franchise area must constitute a market that will attract investment. Because there is no subsidy mechanism, a territory must be economically viable to operate. So, under current federal law, basic service tier rates are enforced by local governments based on federal regulation. All other cable programming tiers are, as a rule, unregulated. The FCC has established a benchmark system for use by local franchising authorities in their determinations of basic service tier rate reasonableness. Under the benchmark system, a cable operator's rates are compared to a set of rates designed to approximate the rates that a cable operator facing competition would charge. Non-regulated cable rates are cost-driven. As mentioned earlier, major inputs into the cable industry's rate-setting structure are capital investment costs, programming costs, labor costs, and general overhead. And pursuant to the 1992 Cable Act, the FCC established customer service standards for cable. Those standards are typically incorporated into local franchises and enforced by local franchise authorities. I've provided a list in the written comments on some of the areas of customer service that are regulated by the FCC, the local franchise authority, or both. In its 60-year history, cable technology and services have continually evolved. The cable industry will continue to innovate, and the cable service of today will look different tomorrow. Television programming, the internet, and broadband service will continue to complement each other. More and more television programming will be watched over the web. Televisions will continue to look and act more like computers. More and more people will continue to watch television programming on computers. At this time, it's unclear how the consumer will interface with this television computer of the future. Some futurists say that television, as we know it today, will no longer exist because it will fully integrate into the web. In this scenario, users will access and watch TV program much like one today surfs the web. Other visionaries believe consumers will continue to demand a simple interface, for example, television channels, and a filtering agent who will sort and present content to the consumer. However, that content will be targeted in smarter ways to audiences, and content will be delivered to consumers in more flexible ways, including through smart televisions, mobile devices, and computers. But one thing we are sure of is the cable industry will continue to operate in this vein, continue to serve, and provide value to its customers. And that includes my prepared remarks.
Thank you. Any questions at this time? Mr. Martin, would you also provide us with a copy of your comments?
Yes, I have.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bass is representing the wireless industry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Bass. I'm the president of AT&T in Minnesota, And I've got the wireless piece of today's presentation. And what I've done is I've taken the questions that Mr. Seufert provided and I've kind of combined them into my presentation, so I'll touch on all the aspects of that. And I know that this committee has had a lot of wireless legislation in front of you over many years, so I won't get to the real, you know, the first day of the wireless industry and then move from that point forward, because I know you guys have a lot of that. But for the sake of today's comments, as you know, the wireless industry got its start in 1983 with the first mobile radio system in Chicago. And since that time, which is a little over 26 years later, the industry has grown to now over 285 million customers in the United States. In Minnesota, that number is about 4.3 million wireless customers. For just kind of some use of wireless customers nationally, last year customers in the United States used 2.275 trillion minutes of wireless voice service and sent over 1.2 trillion text messages. The best way to describe today's wireless industry is hyper-competitive. According to FCC statistics, more than 95% of the U.S. population lives in a census block with at least three wireless providers, and over 60% of the population lives in a census block that has at least five. The barriers for entry for wireless to become a wireless provider are pretty low. Competitors can choose to go through resale agreements with major providers, or they can file with the FCC to get a license to acquire their own spectrum. Obviously, that requires money, so raising capital would be the barrier that a facilities-based wireless provider would face. From a Minnesota perspective, there are no regulatory requirements which stand as an impediment for someone to enter the business. Really, the closest thing that you could, and it's a stretch to come up with kind of an obstacle for wireless carriers would be has been with local governments, and local governments still have the ability to assert their authority over approval of cell towers, whether it's through building permits, zoning, or access to rights of way. But let me emphasize, local governments in Minnesota, at least from AT&T's perspective, have always been very fair, very thorough, and have processed those applications in a timely manner when we've had them. We've had a situation where we get some NIMBY activity and folks love wireless coverage, but sometimes they don't like wireless cell sites, but that's really the extent of it. And one of the protections that the FCC has put in place, if local governments take too long on approving those site applications, is there's now a shot clock in place, which gives wireless companies the opportunity to get court remedy for a situation that's taken too long. For instance, in situations where it's co-location, where you want to put your facilities on an existing cell site, if a local government has taken longer than 90 days, the FCC allows companies to get a court remedy. If you're building a new cell tower from, you know, there's nothing there that's existing now and you're building a new one, it's 150 days. And I think it finds a nice balance because obviously, you know, there's a lot of times local government, they have the issues that they're trying to protect and the issues of constituents within their communities and doing what's best for them at the same time as wireless companies, we're trying to get the balance of building our networks out as quickly as possible. As this committee probably heard over the past several years, in 1993, Congress amended the Communication Act to expressly prohibit states and local government on the regulation of wireless service providers' rates or creating barriers to market entry. But as you know, states would still maintain control over terms and conditions of service. And then, as I had mentioned, local governments still have the control over the things like zoning, permits, and rights of way. And the rationale that Congress looked at back in 1993 is they looked at companies would be operating at a national or at least at a regional level. And the feeling was at that time the best way to allow this industry to grow was to have a light-touch regulatory policy. And I think since you've seen in the past 26 years, what has really developed is a fiercely competitive market, one that's required wireless providers to develop and deliver the most customer service, the most customer-friendly service experience possible, to build out our networks and provide the most advanced and latest and greatest devices to our consumers. And it's been a necessity because with the major providers that provide service today, it's just been something that you've got to do. You either compete or you're going to be out of business. And as a result of this hyper-competitive marketplace, it's been one where where differentiating yourself from other competitors or being able to survive has been part of this consumer-centric response to providing pro-consumer policies. I'm going to go through a handful of examples of things that we've seen as improvements in this industry since legislation came to Minnesota, I believe, in the 2003-2004 timeframe. Some of those things that we see today, customer service summaries. Today, when you go into a wireless store, and I think all providers are in this space now, you're going to receive a copy of what your, for instance, if you've just received a device from one of our, from a wireless provider, you're going to get a summary of what it's going to cost you that day. You're going to get a summary of what your next bill is going to look like and what it should look like on a going forward basis. You're going to have what your plan is, how many minutes you have, if you have a data plan. You're going to have numbers on that piece of paper or piece of papers that are going to guide you if you have questions or problems with billing. There's going to be websites that you can access to get that information as well. One additional thing were return policies. From AT&T's perspective, we have a 30-day return policy. So if you've started service with us, you have up to 30 days to decide, you know, you could decide maybe this was the wrong thing to do. I don't like the device. I don't like you as a company. You can come back to us within 30 days, no questions asked, and you're not obligated on any contract if you chose to go on a contract. I think the lowest number in our industry is probably a 21-day return policy, but I know that at least three of the major providers are at 30 days, and I think one is at 21. Flexible rate plans are things that have been consumer-centric. There are a myriad of rates that every provider, based on what your calling pattern, places you want to call, whether you want international, whether you're looking for a particular country that you dial, there's a myriad of rates and plans that are out there now that all providers have to address. The issue of contracts, I know, has been a big issue here over the years in Minnesota. We now have options of one-year contracts. There are two-year contracts. There are now options for consumers. You have no contract. You don't have to have a contract to have service from us. You can bring a device that's compatible to our network to all wireless providers, and they'll be able to take that device on their network, in which, again, would not be under a contract. One of the latest pro-consumer things that the industry has done is the elimination, or actually not the elimination, but the proration of early termination fees. We see now that every major provider now
I'm
going
to ask whoever has their cell phone on to please turn it off because we're getting a lot of feedback. Sorry.
Good. Thank you. Every provider now prorates their early termination fees, and those go down each month. If someone has decided to go on a contract, that it's now they're prorated and they go down month by month. And in each of the cases, this is something that all providers have to do. In each of the cases where each of these examples I gave, one provider went out and did this to try and do something that their competitors weren't doing. And in response, everybody else followed along. So consumers have benefited greatly. One of the things that I wanted to highlight is showing how consumer behavior is changing these days. For the fourth quarter of 2009, AT&T reported for just the fourth quarter of 2009 that we picked up 2.7 million new wireless customers in the fourth quarter. And I think what is of particular note here is out of those 2.7 million new subscribers, 1.8 million of those subscribers chose to not have a contract. So you can see fully two-thirds of those consumers chose to not have a contract out of those consumers that we picked up in the fourth quarter. So in addition to those consumer-friendly policies that I've just addressed, I think the real game-changer for the wireless industry as well was number portability. And I think everybody in this room can probably think that, you know people and you know them by their wireless number and you really don't want to give up that number. But what number portability has done now is you can take your number to any wireless carrier, and that hasn't always been the case. So it's one of those important things that we possess, and that's our wireless phone number. So as you can see, the consumers are seeing more options on rate plans. They're taking advantage of those options. They're reaping the benefits that we're now seeing on increased network investment, and we're working hard on coverage. And one of the other issues that's come up now in this hyper, not an issue, but one of the things that's come about is in this hyper-competitive industry is it's benefited consumers on the price side as well. About a year, maybe a year and a half ago, Sprint made a decision that they were going to lower the price of their all-everything plan, their unlimited plan, and they dropped that plan by $30 or $40 per month. And what that did is it sent shockwaves through the industry. And soon, one by one, each of the major carriers dropped their rates by the same amount to compete with what Sprint just did, because Sprint was going to definitely have a clear niche in that market where they were going after price for those all-everything plans. And everybody responded, and consumers benefited immediately. And as I mentioned, the barriers for entry in the wireless market are pretty low. And we've seen a lot of other niche carriers that are starting to come in at that lower price point as well. And those came in and cut, even went lower than what Sprint did. You're talking about the Boost Mobiles, the Virgin Mobiles, the Track Phones, Leaps, Cricket, Metro PCS. All of these companies came in with all-you-can-eat plans that were even lower than what Sprint did and what the rest of the industry did to come back. So we're seeing that price competition and pro-consumer policy, all of this is now leading to fewer complaints. I get a report every Monday that shows our consumer complaints in the state of Minnesota, and I see those going down and staying steady. And I think that is it's related to the fact of all of the different changes that have been made by the wireless industry and by AT&T. At the same time, I'm not going to sit here and say that we're perfect. We make a lot of mistakes just like everybody does, but I think the industry has learned from, you know, over those 26 years. You're talking about 7 years ago, an industry that was probably 19, 20, 21 years old. But I think we've learned greatly over that time and have improved the relationship and the things that we do for consumers and have gotten better. Granted, there was the threat of legislation in Minnesota, which I think was a wake-up call for a lot of the industry. And I think that some of those things that have changed are partially a result of that. We knew that there were problems that needed to be addressed, and I think they were successfully addressed. One of the things that we continue to do is to invest in our networks. Everybody, we talk about the competition on price. We talk about the competition on the pro-consumer policies, the way that we're able to survive, and we also compete on what we do with infrastructure and the latest and greatest things that we do for consumers in Minnesota and across the country. On the investment side, it's led to huge investments throughout the United States, but I'll talk Minnesota specific here, and I'll talk AT&T specific since I don't have industry information for the other providers. But since 2007, AT&T has invested over $275 million in the state of Minnesota. We've added 300 new cell sites, and we've upgraded over 300 others. In 2010, our plans are to add 55 new cell sites and upgrade an additional 200 to 3G, which is our wireless broadband. And 3G, and you heard the Mr. Martin and Mr. Young talk about the broadband that's provided. What 3G provides from an AT&T perspective is about 1 to 2 megabits per second. So it's a decent speed for broadband, but that's what 3G provides today. In Minnesota, what that's done, though, is that's led to jobs. AT&T has added jobs over the last 5 or 6 years as we've done this work in Minnesota. But at the same time, it just doesn't benefit AT&T. It's benefited companies across Minnesota because when we do this work, we use contractors and suppliers in Minnesota. So it's benefited them as well as we've expanded our infrastructure and our network. And so really what we as an industry feel over the last 4 or 5 years with all of these investments and all of these changes that we've made on the consumer side of this, but purely on the investment side, we think that in this economy, the wireless industry has been a bright spot for jobs and investment over that period of time. And as I talked about the 3G footprint in Minnesota and some of the additional upgrades that we're doing, I mentioned the speeds that 3G provides. And what that's done is it sets the stage for the next layer of technology that, from an AT&T perspective, that we use, which is high-speed packet access. And that's the next upgrade to our 3G networks. And that provides speeds which are going to be up to 7.2 megabits per second. And that's, again, a pretty darn good speed from a wireless provider. But again, in our network evolution, where we're going with that is then the next upgrade to that network is where you hear the term 4G. Or what is called LTE or long-term evolution. And that's where you can talk about getting speeds of probably around 20 megabits per second. And as this committee saw earlier in the year and then the great work of the ultra-high-speed broadband task force and the report that they did and the goals that they have for 2015, 20 megabits a second is definitely on the radar for what those goals were by 2015. And we feel that the wireless piece of this will provide some of the answers in reaching some of those areas where that 6% that don't get it today, and also for upgrading the speeds and the opportunity for people to get additional competition and for more investment for those 94% of Minnesotans who have access to high-speed broadband. So in conclusion, what we've seen over 26 years with this industry and based on what Congress did in a light-touch regulatory policy is while we've made mistakes over time, we grew quickly, and in a lot of cases I think that we've done things to improve upon and make the experience better every day. It's benefited consumers on choices, on price, and the devices and things that they're able to have access to. So, Madam Chair, with that, that'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Bass. Any questions at this time? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Burke, I think you're here for the panel, right?
Actually, I believe I'm supposed to give a discussion now about access, and then I'm going to be on the panel as well.
Oh, really? Okay.
Unless you don't want me on the panel. That's my understanding.
Go ahead. You can talk to us briefly about access.
Briefly. Okay. I will try to keep this brief. Good afternoon, and thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Jim Burt, and I am with Sprint. I'm a director of policy. I've been with Sprint for 20 years. Sprint is a very diversified company. I've done a lot of different things. As a matter of fact, as the others here have talked, I've dabbled in each of these particular areas. We used to have a local division. Some of you may know United Telephone of Minnesota, which became Sprint, which became Embark, which is now CenturyLink. When I started with Sprint, that's the company that I worked for in Overland Park, Kansas. I am going to talk today about access charges. Access charges is an issue that is common to all of us. I'm not going to say that I'm representing the position of the other three gentlemen here, but I think it's an issue that is common. I think it's worth discussing within the context of the second four questions that you had sent out. Intercarrier compensation or access charges, that's what one carrier pays to another carrier. You heard a little bit about it earlier. And I have a diagram that I believe they were handed out to you. I'm going to talk about two examples of access charges. Diagram one, which you have a black and white version. It looks something like this. Diagram one down at the bottom. This shows how access charges work on wireless calls. So on the left-hand side, you have a wireless customer who is making a call to the customer of a local telephone company. And the wireless company carries that call across its network, hands it off to the telephone company, and then for that last leg to deliver it actually to that end user, we pay the telephone company access charges. I'll talk a little bit later about what some of those charges are. They vary greatly. One of the things I would like to point out about this is when the call goes in the reverse direction, when the telephone company customer calls the wireless company is not allowed, and that was a decision made by the FCC, is not allowed to charge the telephone company, in this case, access charges. We think that that creates a competitive imbalance. I like that word. We typically talk in terms of market distortion because, as we've heard, we are all competing with one another, and this is a case where we think there's an imbalance where we have to pay them, they don't have to pay us. Diagram two, then, which is a long-distance call, a traditional long-distance call where you have two wireline customers calling each other long distance. Generally, there is a long-distance company who is providing that service. They pay on the left-hand side. In this particular case, the call is from the left to the right again. They pay the telephone company on the left-hand side access charges. They call or carry the call across their network, and then they terminate it on the right-hand side, and then they pay the telephone company on the right-hand side access charges as well. This industry has changed considerably. At one point in time, the telephone companies and long-distance companies did not compete with each other. They do now. As a matter of fact, on the left-hand side, I'm sure virtually all, if not all, of the telephone companies in the state of Minnesota also provide long-distance service under their name. They maybe don't have a nationwide network and probably don't, but they provide long-distance service. We are competing with them for the long-distance service. Now, on that originating side, they don't have that access expense on the originating side of the call because it's essentially being paid to themselves. So, again, another market imbalance. Intercarrier comp is a huge issue. Access charge is a huge issue. Recent FCC broadband plan that came out, they identified it as a $14 billion issue. And these are what we call switched access charges, $14 billion within the industry. There are other types of access charges, but I'm only going to talk about switched. And this is the amount of money that actually changes hands between competitors today. The rates, I don't have diagrams to show this, but the rates for access charges vary greatly. Rates between states or interstate rates generally are less than access rates within the state. So that means a call from Minnesota to Wisconsin, the access charges are generally less than the calls within the state of Minnesota. That's just the way it was structured. I do have another diagram. If you want to look at diagram 3, I'm showing some of the rates within the state of Minnesota, comparing some of the different companies. And as you can see, the high bar, those are what we call the intrastate rates. So those are the access charges that apply to those long-distance calls within the state of Minnesota. As you can see, they're considerably higher than the rates on that shorter bar, which are the rates for those particular companies for calls between states. And that is why...
Hasn't that traditionally been the case, though, even on the landlines, that the rates are higher intrastate than interstate?
For long-distance rates, yes. And it's partially due and primarily due to the fact that the access charges are higher for in-state calls. For example, Sprint provides wholesale long-distance. We may provide wholesale long-distance for some of the telephone companies in Minnesota. The cost for us to carry the call on our, what we call a backbone part of our network, is a half a penny or less. But the actual long-distance rates, when you look at how much you have to pay for access on both ends of that call, the long-distance rate obviously is much higher. So the majority of the expense for a long-distance call is access charges. Access charges within the state are higher than those between states. Again, you can call from Duluth to Minneapolis. It's going to cost you a lot more than calling from Duluth to Washington, D.C., and it's primarily due to the fact that the access charges within the state are so high. The other thing I'd like to point out is the function that is being provided by the telephone companies, whether this is an in-state call or a call between states, the function is exactly the same. The rates are just different. At the bottom of diagram 3, I've provided some other numbers. These are some numbers that actually came from the FCC, and these are estimates of what the real cost is of the companies to provide this access service. And as you can see, on a narrowband network, which is we would consider their network today, the typical network today, about 0.2 cents. If you look at the cost of a broadband network, and our networks are migrating to these broadband networks, I think we heard that, there's 6 zeros and a 1. You know, at that point in time, it really is irrelevant how many zeros there are. There are a lot of zeros. So the costs for providing these services are very low. So I mentioned some of the inequities. I think that there are some others. This interstate, intrastate disparity is an issue. Rates higher than costs. These different rates for the different what we call jurisdictions, intra versus interstate, leads to other issues as well. Leads to a thing called rate arbitrage. I'm sure that's a term everybody up here has heard about, and that's where some people will try to manipulate the call and make it look like it's maybe an interstate call when it's really intrastate. Not supposed to do that, but that's what happens. So whenever you have this disparate rate, people are going to try to get the lower rate if they possibly can. It also creates misidentification of traffic, misrating of traffic, and a lot of effort within the industry. A lot of money is spent on us billing each other for these minutes. There's another issue that I don't know if you've heard about, but because some of these rates are pretty high, and it's an issue in Minnesota, it's called traffic pumping. That's one term. Artificial traffic stimulation, where free conference calling, adult chat lines, they just drive a tremendous number of minutes. And typically these are done to the calling party for free, and then the carriers like Sprint, Quest, others end up having to pay these very high access charges. So that's another issue that we have identified that we think needs to be addressed. The rates within Minnesota, we talked about that a little bit, just some averages. The average intrastate rate in Minnesota is about 4 cents. The average interstate rate is about 0.7 cents. So that gives you a feel. Obviously, you saw on diagram three that the rates by company, it varies greatly. It varies greatly depending on who it is. The one thing, I mentioned it, and this is what we typically think of in the industry, is these are rates that these big companies or little companies pay each other. And that's really a misconception. Access rates are actually paid by end users. And at the end of the day, as a service provider, we have to pass on costs. We have to make a profit. So the higher the access rates are, the higher our prices are. We are in a very hyper-competitive industry. So as our costs come down, access charges come down, then you will see that reflected in the retail rates that the real end users end up paying. I have a chart. This would be diagram four. It's the last diagram I have for you. This is an FCC chart, and it really illustrates what I just said. This shows what interstate rates have done over time. That's the high bar. Those are long-distance interstate rates. And that solid dark bar that is within that, that's what interstate access rates have done. As you can see, over time, the two have come down. And again, it's an illustration of the market forces at work. So what can we do? What can we do? This is one of the questions with state law. Several states have done this. And there's actually SF 3368, which was introduced yesterday, is a law that could change the nature of these high intrastate access rates in the state of Minnesota. Many states have done it. There were two states that did it last week, Georgia.
Okay, we're going to leave this for the panel, though. We're in.
Okay.
Okay, because this is a question specifically for the panel.
Okay. Okay. The talking about 3368?
No, we're not going to hear your bill.
That's fine.
Not going to hear your bill today. You can let us know what problems you have and what state legislation might be helpful, but we're not going to hear your bill today.
Okay.
So, okay.
So the point is that many states are addressing the disparity in rates, and we think that can be done here in Minnesota as well.
I do have a question, though.
Sure.
I wasn't sure if I heard you accurately. So if a cell phone user calls a landline, there's an access charge to reach the landline. But if the landline calls the cell phone, there's no access charge to reach the cell phone?
Correct. And that I mentioned, that was a decision that was made by the FCC. It's nothing anybody here
might
did
it be
or
related
cares.
To the fact that maybe cell phone companies are gaining users and landlines are losing users?
Well, it takes a little bit more history than that. The issue of access charges has been before the FCC since 1996. They've had an open proceeding since 2001, and they've recognized and were directed to fix this system. They haven't been able to do that. During that period of time, wireless carriers tried, petitioned to the FCC to try to get so that they could receive access charges. And the FCC said, no, we don't want to perpetuate the system that we know is broken. You guys have done pretty well without access charges to this point in time, so we're not going to let you charge access charges.
And you successfully reduced the rate that you're paying by at least two-thirds.
You were looking at the diagram four. Those are interstate access rates and interstate long-distance rates.
Okay.
And the interstate rates have been coming down over time. They average for Sprint about 0.6 cents per minute.
Okay.
For interstate rates.
Okay. Let's see. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, and maybe Mr. Bass can address this part too, is if I look at, this is a chart from Sprint, right? So would the chart from AT&T reflect the same kind of numbers and terms, or does each carrier have a different rate with all the different land, you know, interlinks and exchange rates or access rates, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, through you to Senator Dahl,
Mr. Bass.
I would say that they're probably fairly close. I can't see that there'd be a big difference from AT&T's compared, you know, what our network costs are. I don't have them in front of me. I can run those down for you. And
they're similar.
I would guess that they've got to be fairly similar.
Thanks.
Okay, let's see. I'm going to excuse some of you gentlemen. I know Mr. Young is staying and Mr. Burt is staying. And I'm going to call Tony Mendoza, Andy Schreiner, and Dan Lipschultz. Ah.
Oh, Andy Schreiner.
Why don't you just introduce yourself for the record? And we'll start with Mr. Burt.
My name is Jim Burt. I'm with Sprint Nextel.
Tony Mendoza, Legislative Counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association.
Randy Young with Minnesota Telecom Alliance.
And Dan Lipschultz, I'm listed here as a lawyer with Moss and Barnett. I'm actually here on behalf of the CLEC Coalition. Moss and Barnett is not yet providing telephone service, and that's a good thing, by the way. My CLEC Coalition is made up of several competitive local exchange carriers, Integra, XL Communications, TW Telecom, and I lose count sometimes. McLeod USA, and I think that's the full list for today.
Okay.
My name is John Stanek. I'm the Minnesota president of Quest Communications. I guess I'm filling in for Mr. Schreiner, who looked panicked when his name was called.
Okay. And I've provided you with a list of prepared questions, and I'm going to go through those questions at this time and ask you to respond to those. How do the differences in regulation outlined in your presentations generate competitive imbalances? So the presentations that were provided earlier. Who would like to start? Mr. Stanek?
I just echo many of the comments that were made by Mr. Young and other panelists that basically when you have a regulatory structure that was focused on monopoly voice services, as we've moved into a competitive environment, with barriers to entry being reduced because of the emergence of technologies that makes it possible to provide services, and the regulatory structure as we're moving from a voice into a data or broadband world imposes regulatory obligations on one segment of a competitive industry, that is a significant imbalance from our perspective that we think impairs our ability in many cases to compete on a level playing field with others.
We don't often agree with Quest, but on this issue we do. Regulations really need to be technologically neutral.
Mr. Lipschultz.
Yes, thank you. Regulations really need to be technologically neutral. At the end of the day, when you're making a phone call or sending a written text message, you're sending electrons out over the airwaves or the wires, and it gets converted either back to a voice or back to a printed page. And no matter what technology you're using, you're ending up essentially with the same communication. And I think that's an incredibly important principle to keep in mind. The only place where I might differ a little bit with a comment Mr. Young made was on the suggestion that competitive local exchange carriers are treated with a lighter hand than incumbent local exchange carriers. At least in Minnesota, with respect to the relationship carriers have with their retail customers, we're not treated with a lighter hand. And if you look at the Commission's rules and regulations, you'll see that, in fact, competitive local exchange carriers have to file tariffs that identify all of their prices, all of the services, the conditions of those services. Competitive local exchange carriers' prices are regulated. We can't charge something that the Commission would consider to be substantially harmful to customers. We can't charge discriminatory rates. Regulations are essentially fairly equal among competitors or between competitors and incumbent carriers with respect to our relationship with retail customers. You have to look at regulation in two compartments. One is regulating the relationship carriers have with their end user customers. That's all of us in this room. The other component or the other compartment is the relationship carriers have with one another on a wholesale basis. And that's where it's different because it has to be different. You have incumbent local exchange carriers who benefited from the quid pro quo that Mr. Young referred to before, where the state got a ubiquitous network out to everybody, and in return, the carriers were able to recover all of their costs because they had no one else with whom they had to compete to get a return on that investment. The world has changed now, and as competitive local exchange carriers have been coming into the market over the last 12 years, we don't have that opportunity to recover all of our costs because we have at least one competitor, and that's the incumbent carrier, and we usually have multiple carriers who are doing exactly what we're doing. So I think you need to look at those two different compartments when you decide sort of whether regulation should be the same or not.
Now I'm an offender. So, Mr. Young, what do you say about that?
Well, again, I think that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are living in artificially created boxes that regulate different industries differently that made a whole lot of sense when they were created many years ago. But as technology is advanced in this industry, those boxes are no longer suitable for the marketplace that we have today or the technology that we have today, and certainly aren't suitable for the customers or the players in the marketplace.
Okay. Mr. Mendoza?
Madam Chair, I generally agree with the statement that Mr. Young made earlier about the fact that a lot of the regulatory disparities are the product of the historical differences between the industries that are appearing before you today, as well as, I think, some of the technological differences between the way the services are delivered, because there are differences in the way that the services are delivered. Some of those services are converging within each provider, but they are delivered in different ways. And I think that is why, for example, the cable industry started as a competitor to broadcast, started as a way to deliver television signals to remote areas of the country that couldn't get television service in the first place by delivering it over coaxial cable. And the need to dig trenches in the ground and build that coaxial cable out to the communities that it was serving resulted in having to deal with local governments. And I think that's the beginning, the genesis of our industry's relationship, regulatory relationship with local governments. It ended up turning into federal issues because a lot of the issues that the broadcast industry were facing were regulated at the federal level. So I think each of the segments, the sectors of the industry that you have before you today are regulated in different ways. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's artificial, but I think it's more in the way that the industry's developed organically in their history that results in the disparities that you have today. And I think each party at the table today could cite to you a list of disparities that they say they have that others don't. Cable certainly has a list of those, franchise fees, peg access requirements, some of the things that Mr. Martin alluded to earlier in his comments. I guess the question would be, in the grand scheme of things, are those imbalances, when you put them on the scale, tipping the playing field one way or the other?
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I was wanting to know is you know, and I agree we're all starting to merge all these different, the different industries are merging together in a sense that they're all carrying the same things, but as we've been talking prior to this and things like smart grid technology, can they address that as a possibility of how data gets transferred as well and how regulation would play into that, or is that outside the scope of what you wanted to talk about?
Well, some of them have touched briefly on that, but maybe we could finish this row of and let Mr. Burt respond to the question, and then you can respond to Senator Dahl after that. So, Mr. Burt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree. I think each of us, depending on which industry, wireless, the telephone company, the incumbent LEC, or the CLEC, cable, we've all kind of grown up independently of one another, and there is a lot of what we call legacy regulation within each of those individual silos. I think we also agree that we all compete with one another. And Sprint, although not as much as what we used to when we had a local telephone company, we don't disagree that as the markets become competitive and as we are competing with one another, that there is less regulation is needed. You know, I talked about access charges. Access charges is just one form of this legacy regulation that is left over, and as these markets become competitive, it distorts that market or creates a competitive imbalance.
Well, I would contend that some of you really feel that less regulation is needed. Some of you have very little regulation.
I think we would all agree that less regulation, and even from my perspective, not being an incumbent local exchange carrier, we don't disagree that as their markets become competitive, they don't need as much regulation. But when that occurs, we want all of the legacy regulation addressed, including access charges.
Okay.
We will police each other pretty well, I believe.
I think it was Mr. Young that said that you all deliver the same service, but you've been using different technology to deliver that. Was that you, Mr. Young?
That's correct, and I'm sure.
Okay. And Senator Dahl, what is your question about that?
Well, and I don't know if the panel can address this, but we were hearing more and more about smart grid technology. Are we going to use the wires to transmit data to be smart with our homes and how we use the electric energy? And I'm assuming that there's going to be a merging of the things that you do. Maybe wireless will be separate. I don't know. But if we're using any kind of cable systems and things like that to deliver data, that's going to go over our wires. And as we're thinking about maybe changes to regulations, how is that going to impact, if you can, what you do? And how should we be looking at this as we go forward?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Young.
Senator Dahl. We have been looking at that issue of smart grid, too. As a matter of fact, we have started a pilot project with three cooperative telephone companies that have overlying service areas with three of the electric co-ops to see how we can be cooperating and working together on delivering smart grid technology to our joint customers. If that goes well, we'd like to start doing that in other parts of the state. As a matter of fact, we're having a conference next week with electric co-ops and our members to begin to talk about developing those relationships.
Would anybody else like to respond? Mr. Burt.
Madam Chair, Senator, absolutely. We've probably all heard it, but any device that has any kind of a microprocessor in it, as we look into the future, is going to be connected to something else. I mean, we can see how easily that can be done today. A lot of us probably have Wi-Fi in our homes, or we have our own wireless network within our home. Mine just happens to connect back to my cable modem, and then I get to the Internet. There are technologies available today where I could come in, if I had the right refrigerator, thermostat, I could come in. As a matter of fact, our electrical company was trying to give away thermostats that I could control remotely via the Internet. Sprint has been involved in this from a wireless perspective, and we call this machine-to-machine. We actually have a division or department within Sprint that is focusing entirely on this machine-to-machine communication over wireless broadband networks. So very definitely, and of course, the smart grid is one aspect of that.
Madam Chair, what I'm thinking is there going to be, I mean, you're going to be able to give us some ideas on how you would project regulations. If you're going to look at differences in regulations, will your industry be able to come forward with recommendations on how you can integrate as we move forward? Because the utilities are regulated industries and will continue to be, and so we're going to have to find a way to maintain some sort of competition and keep our costs down while we continue to allow innovation to move forward, in that industry. And we'd like to see it moving quickly, more quickly than not. We don't want to have obstacles. So if we start looking at the telecommunications industry and reshaping regulations at all, I think this is going to have to be a big component of it. And obviously, if you're talking with the industry now, your input is going to be vital. I don't know if you have some thoughts on that at this point or not, but.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl,
Mr. Mendoza.
I think a lot of that innovation is already happening without having to enact regulation. I just attended a conference for a week long down in Virginia on smart grid technology. And a lot of it is, to the extent that the devices are available, the smart refrigerators, the smart dryers that allow you to self-regulate your energy use and the time of day usage that you, the time of the day that you use particular appliances, with rates that are fully transparent from the electric utility, the broadband infrastructure to provide that service into the home is already there. You can download a Google application now that will allow you to look at your energy usage throughout the course of a day. Soon, I think you'll be able to map that against the peak usages in or the peak demands on a daily basis from in terms of how much electricity we use, and then determine whether you're using your appliances at the correct time of the day or paying the highest rate possible or the lowest rate possible. So in terms of the ability for the user to get that information into their home through broadband, that's already there. Where I think we're maybe a little bit behind is in actually the devices. You can see there's a lot of them in new homes, in new construction, but to get that into some of the older homes that might have older built-in appliances and things like that might be an area that we need to work on.
Okay, we're going to go ahead with prepared comments, and then if there are other questions later, then we can ask other questions. So the next question is, what issues are of most concern for your industry regarding state and local laws? And Mr. Burt, access might be a good time for you to talk about this. Otherwise, like statewide cable franchising or municipal entry into broadband. Would you like to start, Mr. Burt?
Madam Chair, I believe you gave me the license now to talk about the legislation.
yes, right.
Yeah, I talked about access charges, and I think that's an issue that can be addressed in Minnesota. 3368 is an attempt to do that. That is not unlike what other states have done. What it does is it brings the in-state rates or the intrastate rates down to the interstate level, and then it provides a means by which the telephone companies can go to the commission, and if they can show that they need some recovery, either through rate rebalancing, which is increasing the local rates to offset the reduction in access, they have to go to the commission to show that, or potentially receiving money out of a state fund, which would be funded by carriers. Depending on who we represent, our positions on those issues will be different, and I won't get into that. But that is a mechanism that is not inconsistent with what the FCC has proposed. I mentioned earlier the FCC, they issued their broadband plan. In it, they address intercarrier compensation. There are numerous comments as to the harms created by the intercarrier compensation system that we have. And their plan is to reduce those charges basically to zero over a very long period of time. Because this is so large, and this is one of, I think, about 63 proceedings they're going to have to implement this, we don't think we can wait. That's why we here at the state, it's a recognized issue. We see it is seen as a hindrance to broadband.
Okay, so you don't have to sell us at this time. We just want to hear what it is.
Well, again, in a nutshell, it is reducing those intrastate rates to interstate levels and on a case-by-case basis giving the telephone companies the opportunity to show the commission is the expert agent, they know, they can confidentially look at the earnings, revenues of the companies and determine whether or not they need any revenue recovery for the access revenue reductions.
Any other concerns about state and local laws?
I don't think any that you haven't heard already today, and in the interest of time, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Mendoza.
Madam Chair, well, the cable industry, as Mr. Martin alluded to earlier, and you had some questions to him about that, but we certainly are concerned about efforts to lower or make it easier for municipalities to compete with the private sector by building and operating their own municipal telecommunications networks. That's an area of major concern for us, and we look forward to having a dialogue with you and the other members of the committee about that. I just wanted to talk. There were a couple questions that I wanted to pick up on that you had asked Mr. Martin a little earlier.
I would just contend, though, that it's probably harder in Minnesota for the municipality to enter the cable market than or the broadband to deliver broadband services than in any other state.
I don't know if that's necessarily true, and I guess I'm, from our perspective, we're not sure that that's such a bad thing for it to be difficult. It was difficult for us to get into this business. It's a major capital investment that needs to be made, and it's a major long-term commitment to maintaining a very complex set of relationships and a very complex network that, you know,
well,
it looks easy in your home, but it may not be. It's not as easy as it looks.
Yeah. Well, when I see services being provided to everybody, then I might agree with you, but it's not occurring right now.
And Madam Chair, we would like to know where those particular communities are. We'd love to have a discussion with you about that. The problem that we have with municipal ownership is that a lot of the communities that are proposing it are served by several competitors. We just went through an election, a special election that was defeated in North St. Paul, in which is the middle of probably one of the most competitive areas in the state. That's where we have a great amount of pause when it's not an unserved area that's asking to do this. It's areas that are well served.
And I might argue it's a lot easier for you to pour the money into defeating the election than it is to delivering the service.
Well, it puts a lot of private capital at risk. It is a big deal to the cable industry to have a subsidized government competitor come in and try to compete with millions of dollars of investment that have been made over the years and that are providing good services to customers.
Okay, so we're not going to hear that bill right now either, but it is an issue.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Dibble.
And people need to support their statements. In what way are we talking about subsidized? I mean, you know, just taking a swipe at local government. I think local government provides some services pretty well and pretty efficiently.
So what is your question to
Mr. Mendoza? What are you talking about when you say subsidized government competitors?
Cheaper cost of capital is the biggest subsidy. The ability to fund municipal systems with general obligations rather than through its own revenue stream as a business model. The cable industry can't go tax customers to help fund their operations. The city has the ultimate authority to do that.
Not how utilities operate. Like I said, I do think we need the other side of the story at some point.
Sure. And we're not hearing the bill right now. We're just hearing the industry's concerns. You had some others that you wanted to
add to. Tax parity is an issue that we think needs to be studied. It gets to the regulatory disparity issue. There are differences in how these industries are taxed. Some of them are also dependent on which jurisdiction is regulating that particular industry. For example, there are disparities between how cable is taxed and how the satellite business is taxed, and we'd certainly love to have a conversation about that as well. And then we're always concerned about bills that we believe create an unlevel playing field for one class of competitor over the other, and those will always be bills that we'll take a close look at.
Mr. Young.
Madam Chair, I think our primary concern at this point, of course, would be access charges. As I'd indicated earlier, the three-legged stool for the independent telephone companies, historically a third of the revenues to support lower rates and reasonable rates in rural Minnesota come from access charges. That percentage has been decreasing significantly, not necessarily that access rates have been going down, but that the number of minutes have been going down as folks are using their free cell phone for long distance rather than using the traditional long-distance telephone. So when they go off the long-distance network and go to cell phone, access minutes go down, so access revenues go down. If intrastate access charges were to decrease to the interstate rate, you would be looking at a $7 per month per customer increase. Right now, on average, for the MTA members, basic service is about $14 a month. If access charges went down, intrastate went down to interstate, you'd be looking at a $21 rate rather than a $14 rate, unless there was some other mechanism for making that up. Evidently, and I've not had a chance to study the bill yet, having it just introduced yesterday, the Public Utility Commission at this point has the ability and the authority, and in fact they have in a couple of recent cases, looked at individual telephone companies' intrastate access charge rates and lowered them in a negotiated agreement between the long-distance company and the local company. The ability is there right now for regulators to handle on a case-by-case basis inequities or differentiations between rates. You have to remember that the rates are based on the cost of providing the service for that local telephone company. Intrastate access rates are substantially lower in the Twin Cities than they are in northwestern Minnesota. The cost of providing service to a customer in the Twin Cities is a lot lower than it is in northwestern Minnesota.
Mr. Lipschultz?
And I'll add that access charges are actually a concern for competitive local exchange carriers as well as the rural incumbent carriers. Let's look, for example, at the FCC's broadband plan, and they do call for a reduction of intrastate access rates down to interstate levels, but only after 5 years and only after, I think, what Sprint's representative referred to as 63 or so proceedings. And let's look at each component. First of all, why wait 5 years? Well, because the FCC recognizes that when you reduce access charges substantially, you're causing some potentially major disruption to the industry. The economics of the industry are built on a panoply of regulations and rules that have existed for quite some time. You need to be careful when you make a major move that you don't do it too quickly and that folks have time to prepare for it. Let's look at why the FCC has said, well, we're going to need a lot of due process and a lot of proceedings. And that's because, as Mr. Young said, the access charge issue, like almost every issue in this industry, is highly fact-intensive. You need a fact-finding process administered by a regulatory body to effectively address most of the issues in our industry. And so when you ask sort of what are concerns, I don't know that CLECs have specific concerns with particular regulatory issues now, but we have a general concern with the way these issues are approached. And one of them, I think it speaks to the issue of access charges, is be careful, go slowly, and use fact-finding processes that you have in place with regulatory agencies that are fully equipped to deal with these issues. Secondly, don't get caught up in fads, one of which I think, and I hate to call it a fad, and I think that's a little bit of an overstatement, but fiber. Fiber is a wonderful thing, but most people don't have fiber to their homes or businesses right now, and it's a long time before it will come. In the meantime, copper, the existing copper network, can produce and provide high-speed data access, the likes of which we'd never seen before. And that's the innovation that the competitive market has produced over the last 5 years. Not just my companies, but Quest as well, have innovated in this competitive market and have found technologies that can take the existing copper network and deliver not only voice but data, and not only data but at extraordinarily high speeds that were never contemplated before. That's a good thing for end user consumers. My clients generally serve small and medium-sized business customers. They'll never be able to afford a build-out of fiber to their businesses. So what we've been able to do, and Quest and other carriers in this competitive market, is bring the copper technology up to a level where it can provide small and medium-sized businesses the sorts of speeds and data services that only the very largest companies might otherwise get through a direct fiber link. So I think sort of those, in addition to technological neutrality, are some important guideposts I think everyone who's making policy in this industry should keep in mind.
And I don't think that our Minnesota goals are in the way. They look at penetration rate and speed, not the technology that's used.
Madam Chair, absolutely. In fact, the failure, I think, to adhere to the principle of technological neutrality is a failure at the FCC, not here. In fact, yeah, your goals in your statutes today in Chapter 237 are, I think, exactly as the goals in this industry ought to be. And there's limits on what you can do because of what the FCC has done, but I think to the extent you're involved and active in this area, there are guideposts that you have, I think, adhered to and would recommend you continue to.
Thank you. Mr. Stanek.
Madam Chair and members, as I indicated previously, I think that this pivot from a voice world to a data or broadband world, when we look at state laws, is important to look at. In the broadband or data world, we're going to be providing voice services, data services, and video services over a technology that wasn't in existence when that statute was designed. I think to Senator Dahl's question earlier, I think it's in the state's best interest to have everyone at this table, all of our companies, competing with each other to innovate the types of products and services that are going to be good for Minnesota businesses and Minnesota consumers. And so we, like others, are looking at smart grid technologies because at the end of the day, we're going to be able to sell you a connection that's fairly similar in terms of what consumers want or businesses want. Where we will succeed or fail in the marketplace will be in those areas where we're offering the consumer something of value. For us, we're very proud of our service technicians and the work they do. We put a great reliance on that as part of our effort to convince customers to come to us and stay with us. But it's also making sure that we're innovating. We're taking a look at the landscape out there and say, what is it that people want to bring into their home to make their lives easier, whether it's monitoring their energy consumption, all the range of things that can make people's lives easier. Those are the add-ons that we can use our networks to supply. And it's important we have a regulatory structure that doesn't discriminate in any way between the various types of way you're getting into the home. Secondly, I would just say that in terms of another area of state law, I think we lag a little bit. I know that some legislation moved this session that starts with the work of implementing the recommendations of the Broadband Task Force, but there's much more in that report. We all recognize the state's financial condition, but we lag behind other states in terms of adoption strategies. We lag behind other states in encouraging investment. There are other states that aren't caught in this provider versus government battle as much, and they're figuring out ways that in high cost to serve areas, are there ways that we can partner between government and private providers to bring services to those areas? One example that would be on the federal level right now with the broadband stimulus dollars that are specifically targeted to provide incentives to bring services to unserved areas that currently under economic models that providers use, there's not a return on investment case that could be made, but the government has said at the federal level, we need to make sure that every American has access to broadband at some certain level. It's a perfect example of way that the government and the private providers can work together to bring things to the people in Minnesota that need it. So I think as you continue to explore this issue in future hearings and into next session, we hope to come forward as an industry with some ideas about how we can build public-private partnerships as were recommended by the Broadband Task Force.
We've just received notice that our caucus has started, so we're going to have to move ahead. And Mr. Stanek, you started the final question. We're going to skip the one about federal regulations at this time. But I'm wondering if each of you could just briefly address what state regulations you figure we should focus on in the interim that would help us meet our state goals.
Sure. And I, Madam Chair and members, I think I just mentioned a few. I think there are a number of good recommendations in the Broadband Task Force report that give the state a roadmap for things that can be done. to build out to unserved areas to address those issues. Also, there are a number of Minnesotans that have a broadband connection, but they aren't utilizing it for a variety of reasons. What can be done to build those adoption strategies? And I think at the same time, during the interim, one of the things members of the legislature can look at is, as was mentioned earlier, the FCC has designed a federal broadband plan, a national broadband plan. I think that bears monitoring to figure out what components of that may be applicable and helpful to Minnesota. I know that one of the statements we would make is that the Universal Service Fund at the federal level was originally designed to make sure that every American had access to voice service. And now we have situations where multiple carriers are providing services into the same area. They're wireline, they're wireless. I think we're pretty close to being able to declare victory in the effort to get every American voice services. We got a long way to go in getting every American broadband services. So why don't we look, without creating new mechanisms, a way to use that federal universal service fund to talk about universal service in a different way, and that's broadband connections that will allow you to have voice services, data services, and video services. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Lipschultz?
The first broadband service that consumers saw was DSL, and we're all familiar with that. And DSL was somewhere on a laboratory floor somewhere before the 1996 Telecom Act that brought competitors into the industry, and it was a competitive carrier, one of the clients I represent, who brought DSL into the marketplace. So my advice to meet most, if not all, of the goals in the broadband plan and in the goals that you set, competition is the key. And anything and everything you do to promote competition, to continue the development and fostering of competition, will be probably the best thing you can do to bring about the goals you're seeking. And that is really the deployment of advanced services and more services, especially data out to folks who don't have it. To the extent the market fails, you'll see where the market fails and you'll have to intervene. And again, as Mr. Stanek said, partnerships, private and public, are one way to deal with that. There are all sorts of ways you can deal with market failure, but you have to give the market every chance to succeed because, in our experience, it's worked.
Do you feel like you're playing on a level playing field in this competition?
Madam Chair, I don't think anyone up here believes they're playing on a level playing field. We all think we're going uphill both ways.
Yeah.
You know, we'd have to break that down and look at the specifics. For the most part, we believe in the retail world, where we're relating to our retail customers and Quest is as well, regulations are fairly well balanced. It's an uphill battle when, you know, your revenue in 1 year is the same as your competitor's revenue in 1 week. But you innovate when you're small, you're more supple, and you're able to do things perhaps that the larger carrier can't do. I think the real concern for us is this wholesale market, because we're not in business if we can't lease that last mile component of Quest's network at a reasonable rate and on reasonable terms and conditions. If that were to go away, we wouldn't be in business, and small and medium-sized businesses wouldn't have any competition, or perhaps might have a duopoly between the incumbent Quest and the cable company. So that's really our focus, and you know, whether regulations are fair or not, I think, is something that's in the eye of the beholder.
Mr. Young?
Madam Chair, I think that it's incumbent on the legislature to begin to look at areas where state law or state policy is impeding the adoption of broadband. As the study that the mapping study that the State Head Commission shows, 94% of Minnesotans have access to broadband today. For the independent companies, that number is far higher. We literally have cabins on Lake of the Woods that have got broadband and fiber available to them today. The issue is, how do we get people to adopt it and to use it to have the full benefits of it? We have tax policy today that's running counter to that. The income tax credit that you get as a parent for student expenses specifically excludes internet access as one of those things that you can deduct from your income tax. Georgia had a very creative program for promoting telework, where there was a state subsidy that went to either the employer or the employee for teleworking, depending on the number of days a week that they teleworked. I think there are a number of areas where the state can be looking at ways to foster the use of broadband rather than inhibit it.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Mendoza.
Madam Chair, I agree with just about everything that's been said up to this point, particularly that in making legislative policy, we should really be focusing on the unserved. There are areas of the state that are unserved with broadband service, and our policies really should be focusing on those people. And that doesn't necessarily mean people in remote locations. There are, as Mr. Stanek alluded to, a number of reasons why people may not have the ability to use the technology that they have access to. And the cable industry has a program that it just launched this year called Adoption Plus that we would be interested in talking more about, which includes digital literacy training for low-income populations, a subsidized computer program to get computers into homes, into low-income homes, and then service discounts provided by the cable industry to help make access more affordable. We think this program is consistent with a lot of the goals that were set out in the Broadband Task Force report. So I guess the message that we would leave you with is focus on unserved areas and on making access to that technology or the ability to use the technology that they have easier for low-income populations.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devil.
Well, we passed a bill, and it's now been signed that accomplishes
prior like bill.
Exactly. Unserved folks that are pretty close to the core of the city, so I'm pretty happy that we went at least a small step of the way towards addressing that issue.
Mr. Burt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think as you're looking at how to solve the problem in Minnesota, I think a common theme you heard is competitive neutrality. And I think we have to look at that both from a retail perspective as well as from a wholesale perspective. I understand the CLEC dilemma. CLECs cannot and should not overbuild the network. We already have two or three networks out there already. They shouldn't waste their money putting another pair of copper out to a premise. So they should have access to the facilities that are there. I think on another level, the subsidies program. I guess not surprised that the independents have a broader broadband footprint than all of the state of Minnesota combined. There are a number of programs out there that enable them to do that, and I think that's fantastic. So it sounds like it's not a supply, it's a demand issue in some cases. And I didn't read the entire task force report, but there was something that I noticed, and it's on page 66-2C. It looks like one of the ideas was to provide some sort of subsidy to the purchaser of the broadband service. Today on the telephone side, we have Lifeline LinkUp, which provides a discount to the installation and a discount to the monthly rate. So provide the subsidy to the purchaser rather than to the provider. We have competitive providers. The networks are there. Let's get the money into the hands of the people that make the buying decision. That's not inconsistent with an idea that Sprint has floated at the federal level for the federal universal service plan that is being looked at now. And I think that's a viable approach.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions from the senators? Do any of you gentlemen have any last comments? Well, I thank you all very much. The gentlemen that were up at the table before and you, and we really appreciate the time that you put into providing us with the information and helping to educate us about telecom.
Thank you.
And
we'll be happy to work with you. Meeting is adjourned.